I'm Phil Latzman. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN, our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on state, regional news, local news, and issues affecting our community with a panel of the area's top journalists. And before we introduce them, I'd like to thank all of those who've pledged to make this show possible. If you do like what you hear and want to continue us to continue bringing programs like the Florida Roundup, make your contribution in the next hour at WLRNradio.org or at 866-247-9576. And that's all I'll say about that. And thank you for those that have already contributed. On our panel this week, we will introduce a newcomer. She is the Sun Sentinel's Capital Bureau Chief. She comes to us from Tallahassee. Welcome to Kathleen Hawney. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Here in Miami, in the studio with us, is the executive editor of El Nuevo Herald, the Spanish language publication, a branch of the Miami Herald, and a newsroom compatriot, Mr. Manny Garcia. Good to see you, sir.
Great to see you.
And Janie Campbell is the founding editor of the Huffington Post Miami, the website that has been around for a couple of years here, of course, a part of the bigger Huffington Post empire. Janie, we welcome you back as well.
Thanks for having me.
And let's begin. We should tell people that is your show, too. We want you to be part of the online discussion as we go on this hour at WLRN.org. Also, on Twitter at WLRN. Now, for feedback anytime, we have a Facebook page. That's the Florida Roundup on WLRN. And we do encourage you to become part of our informed army by being a member of the Public Insight Network. And that's easy to do. You can sign up at WLRN.org/insight. Let's begin with the new American Pope. Pope Francis may not be from the United States, but for many in South Florida, the fact that he is from Argentina is even better. Miami Archbishop Thomas Wenske hailed the selection of Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio as, quote, a great thing for the United States and Latin America.
Francis is an American coming from Latin America, from Argentina, Buenos Aires. Latin America, as Pope Benedict described it, is the continent of hope. And it is the continent in which we have the largest growing number of Catholics in the world.
And Archbishop Wenske says the choice of Bergoglio as the first pope from the Americas was a shrewd move by the Catholic Church.
As the focus of the population center of Christianity moves away from Europe because of the secularization of Europe, we can see that Latin America was a natural place for a future pope to come from.
So Manny Garcia, he is of Argentinian, an Argentinian of Italian descent, so it's kind of like getting two for one for the Vatican. How much was politics involved with this
well,
move?
Well, it makes perfect sense. As Pope John Paul, two popes ago, had said that what was going to save the Catholic Church, one of the key things was the charismatic Catholic movement that's going through South America. And this is key because exactly as Wenske said, this is the growth opportunity for the church. This is where basically they're planting seeds, if you will. And Pope Francis, like I say, he brings great hope because he's a man of the streets. It's been described in his profiles. He takes public transportation. He went up against, in essence, speaking truth to power to the Kirchners, a former president who passed away and his wife, Christina Kirchner, on several issues where he basically went toe-to-toe with them.
Gay marriage, social issues.
Exactly. A key issue for him was there was a topic in Argentina where children of unwed mothers or single mothers would not be baptized, and he absolutely said, well, no, that's absolutely not going to happen. Jesus was not about that. Jesus was about inclusion and love. And so he's seen as a man who will take on thorny issues that's seen as being ignored.
How surprised were you? And I think we were talking about this on the show. I don't think if they had named a pope from Europe, it certainly would have not have topped our program here today. But how surprised were you that we have an American pope?
Well, it is. It shows you that the pundits, that we really don't know much of anything, because the part of the wisdom was, oh, it's going to be Scola from Milan. And it turns out they choose the candidate from Argentina, which I think, again, it's the signal is that the Americas, it's shifting from Europe, And it shows you the influence and the clout, the growing clout of Latin America, which plays perfect for our audience here in South Florida.
And, of course, here in South Florida, we have the largest, or at least Miami Beach does have, the largest concentration of Argentinians in the United States. At St. Joseph's Catholic Church, near the heart of North Beach's Little Buenos Aires, Peruvian parishioner Millie Miranda says that she hopes the new pope will serve as a voice for impoverished people in third world countries.
We have hunger there. People are in need. So I think he's in touch with real people, you know, for what's going on.
St. Joseph's pastor, Father Juan Sosa, is from Cuba. He says when he heard the news that the Archbishop of Buenos Aires was chosen as the new pontiff, his jaw dropped.
And then I says, this is terrific. This is someone who's going to bring his own experience of pastoral life, as well as his simplicity as a bishop of the church, a cardinal, and also his knowledge and identification with the poor and the needy throughout the world.
And so Manny, Argentinian Pope resounding here in South Florida. We have all over Latin America and South America people who live here, but especially a large number of Argentinian expatriates.
Sure, and Argentina can now claim they have a Pope who comes to them, and they have the best soccer player in the world in Lionel Messi.
And he knows soccer, and he knows
sure
basketball,
does.
And he's anyway. There's also been people wondering, and Tim Padgett is a great writer who's been on the show. Wondered this week in Time Magazine, quote: "As leader of Argentina's Jesuit priests in the 1970s, did he ever denounce the sadistic right-wing military junta of that era, which tortured and killed some 30,000 suspected leftists?" This is difficult for any pope politically.
Yeah.
You mentioned some of the battles he's gotten into, there's obviously a background there.
We haven't found that. Again, there's more. A lot more is going to come up in the following days, and it's already coming up. But like I say, so far the report card has been very, very positive that he's going to be a guy who's going to tackle issues that pretty much have been ignored.
And Janie and Kathleen, just to get your thoughts on this, but Janie, you work in South Florida. You're from Lakeland area, but obviously the story resounds with a Latin American pope a lot greater down here. It means a lot to us here in South Florida. We're not necessarily the rest of the state. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I think that's true, although I do know, Catholics across Florida, I think, will identify with him. Even if the Argentinian population isn't as large, you know, there's so much influence throughout the state. So it's pretty exciting. And I think people will be really inspired by that. I also think that reaching out to that population is not necessarily the church's largest problem. So he's going to have a tough job ahead of him.
And Kathleen, how does the news ring up there in Tallahassee?
Well, I mean, I would agree that it probably is a much bigger deal down there, given the Hispanic population. But I think in general, people were following this very closely. I know, I was at a press conference when the news came out, but I was looking at my phone and, you know, Twitter and Facebook were just lit up, everyone talking, you know, noting that the new pope had been chosen and you know, saying stuff about, his name's going to be Francis. So I think everyone was paying attention I think most people were very excited to see that it was not a European this time.
And it was interesting to note that announcement happened at the exact same time that the announcement from the governor and from the FDLE was happening concerning this internet cafe, this scandal now burgeoning, which we're going to talk about. So the timing was interesting. We did ask for members of the Public Insight Network. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. To reset things, we're here with Manny Garcia, who is executive editor for El Nuevo Herald. Also with us is Janie Campbell from Huffington Post Miami. And on the line with us from Tallahassee is Kathleen Hawney, who is the South Florida Sun Sentinel's Tallahassee Bureau Chief. We've got a lot of state stuff to get into. Before we do that, though, let's hit the phones, and members of our Public Insight Network will have a chance to chime in on what is the story of the week of the Pope, the new Pope. And Matthew is in Miami. Matthew, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Good to have you.
Hi, how are you?
So, you say you almost became a Jesuit priest.
Yeah, most of my 20s I spent trying to decide one way or the other about becoming a Jesuit.
But you have some questions about the new pope.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are some questions. I mean, one is that if he is a typical Jesuit in terms of theological or doctrinal issues, I think that he'll have a reasoned, logical approach with an eye towards what he perceives as truthful in terms of God's will and perhaps with less regard to traditional views in making his decisions. The Jesuits have a history of stepping out on theological issues. I mean, for example, Teilhard de Chardin, a trained paleontologist who was a Jesuit, who was part of the team that identified Peking Man and was the first Catholic theologian to write about the science versus religion controversy in regard to human evolution, was silenced by the Vatican, only to have his writings used as texts in Catholic seminaries around the world 20 years later.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that the Pope will not be afraid to say, based on his interpretation of the Gospels, whatever, what he thinks is truthful, regardless of what others think. I do think there's also, you know, really good news in terms of his new role as shepherd of the Church, in terms of his public humility, you know, the way he lived, you know, living in an apartment, you know, not in the bishop's residence, cooking his own meals, it was mentioned earlier. I think that'll have a huge impact on the sort of the pomp and circumstance of the Vatican, and hopefully an impact on the clergy all the way down to the parish level around the world. And leading by example, I think, is the critical thing that goes on there.
I spent some time at Fordham University, which is run by Jesuits, and I'm Jewish, and they made me feel as if they were more of a progressive sect of Catholicism, if that's the right word. Is that, obviously, Catholicism is not known for its liberal thinkings or leanings, but is this Pope coming from Jesuits, do you feel that he may have different thoughts about things that are a little bit more liberal than the rest of the Church?
I think that's going to depend upon what area you're talking about. I think in terms of, like, moral theology, you know, the question about, you know, birth control and like that, I don't think you're going to see a lot of movement there. I do think, though, that one of the questions is going to involve how he handles the issue of the dramatic decline of the numbers of priests, particularly in the West. And that raises the possibility of at least opening discussions, maybe not going there, but opening discussions about married priesthood and the role of women in the Church. I think that's something that he may surprise people in terms of the willingness to at least examine the issue. You know, not just sort of rubber stamp the wave, well, it's been this way for how long and we're just going to keep doing it, you know, put your head in the sand kind of approach.
Manny, what do you think? Could there be a shifting of the sands here?
To that extent, as far as married priest, I don't see that in the immediate future, but to the caller's point, I mean, it's absolutely right. First of all, this is the first Jesuit priest, which in itself is a tremendous move. And the Jesuits are basically what you, as you follow anybody who's a Jesuit, you see it's all reasoned analytical thinking. You know, there's not just something off the cuff. And they're not afraid to challenge ideas thoughtfully and aggressively. So I think it's a great move. The caller's spot on. And there's going to be great opportunity, but change immediately, it doesn't quite happen that way.
Thanks, Matthew, very much for the call and your insights. And one more from Jose in Miami. Jose, we welcome you to the Florida Roundup.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. How are you?
Good. So you say you believe this Pope has an opportunity.
I think he has an opportunity. There's a couple of things. Number one is he comes outside or he comes from outside of Europe, which is a very interesting situation because they had another Argentinian who they could have chosen, who has been in Europe for a very long time, and that's Leonardo Sandri. And they chose not to choose him. They chose somebody outside. And I think that that's a very interesting thing because if you look at the Catholic world today, they are more represented in Latin America and in Africa than any place else. So if you're looking for the average Catholic, you're more than likely going to find them in those locations. Finding somebody from there to lead the Church is a very interesting move. Second, because this individual seems to have selected Francis and seems to be an individual that is going to say to the Church, you need to be more humble, you need to be more down to the roots. I think that message, not only in selecting the Pope and the Pope choosing that, but the message that is going to descend to the rest of the clergy as well as to the Catholic Church is that we really need to become more humble, that we really need to go back to the things that the Church and the religion is about, which is caring for the other. necessary for somebody else.
Yeah, named after St. Francis of Assisi. Jose, thanks very much for your call. And we could, as usual, probably do a whole hour on this. We do have a couple other panelists, and we're going to get into some other issues. Thanks for all of your feedback on this, as that conversation, I'm sure, will continue on NPR and elsewhere. I'm Phil Latzman. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll get into the big state news this week, the resignation of the lieutenant governor and other things that have happened from session 2013. Stay with us. We're back in just a moment. We welcome you back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN, reintroducing our guests. Manny Garcia is executive editor of El Nuevo Herald. Kathleen Hawney is the South Florida Sun Sentinel's Tallahassee Bureau Chief. She's with us from the Capitol, and also here in Miami with us is Janie Campbell, who's with Huffington Post Miami. We'll get into some local stuff a bit later on as well. And your questions are welcome, and you can always email us at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com, thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. You can tweet us at @WLRN. I'm at Phil Latzman. Manny, I know you're Manny_Garcia1, right?
That's right.
Janie, you have an interesting Twitter handle?
HuffPost Miami.
HuffPost Miami. Okay, and back in Tallahassee, Kathleen, spell yours out for us.
Sure. It's @KHAUGHNEY.
Let's get into this now, Kathleen, with the mushrooming political scandal unfolding in Tallahassee. It involves gambling operators posing as a veterans charity, and in the investigation's wake, Florida's lieutenant governor abruptly resigned this week because of her connection to the case. Here is the governor, Rick Scott, at a news conference on Wednesday afternoon.
Lieutenant Governor Carroll resigned in an effort to keep her former affiliation with the company from distracting from our efforts to help make sure we do the right thing for Florida families. She was involved in a company that we know has been involved in criminal activity. It's very disappointing to have to bring this news to you.
The Navy veteran, former State House legislator, once ran a public relations firm that represented Allied Veterans of the World, which was allegedly a front for an internet gambling operation. First of all, Kathleen, do we know that for sure, or these things are being alleged?
Well, the state and federal officials had a press conference the other day. They issued 57 arrest warrants. They seem to have substantial proof that Allied Veterans took in about, I believe the figures were about $290 million, but only gave $6 million of it to charity. So, you know, we'll continue to see the investigation play out. At the press conference, it was indicated that possibly more arrests could be coming down the pipe. So I think we're probably going to learn a lot more in the days ahead.
More arrests, possibly connections to politicians, or are we just talking about the network itself?
Well, I think I think it could be all manner of things. I mean, right now, Scott said in his press conference the other day that it did not look like, or he said he had no knowledge of Jennifer Carroll doing anything wrong. She was interviewed by authorities. So right now, it doesn't look like she is the target of any sort of investigation, nor does it look like any of the other politicians so far are any targets. But what we do know is that internet cafes, including Allied Veterans, gave a heck of a lot of money to our elected officials. I believe it was over $1 million. So right now, both political parties are going back and trying to go through their books, see where all the money came from, and make a decision about what they're going to do with it. It's kind of an ever-evolving story.
Yeah, as per Jennifer Carroll, her resignation is really not, I guess, a huge surprise, although the timing was. Some say she was a political liability, and then there were allegations made by a former staffer last year that she was having an affair with a female aide, to which Jennifer Carroll responded, quote, "Black women who look like me don't have relationships like that." We remember that, but then she's on trial now, this accuser, for sharing illegal recordings of conversations with her chief of staff. So there was some of that going on in the background as well. Do you think that had to do with her resignation as much as the connection to the internet cafe?
Well, I think, there's a lot of speculation that Governor Scott wanted to dump her for his reelection bid. And he was asked during the press conference if he had planned on having her on the ticket, you know, prior to this all coming out. And he wouldn't answer the question. He said something along the lines of, well, I don't need to talk about that now. So this may have been basically a good excuse for him to get her to resign. As you mentioned, she had not had the easiest tenure as lieutenant governor. She'd stepped in hot water a number of times, including the comments you mentioned about saying women that look like her are not lesbians. I mean, that created a huge uproar amongst the gay and lesbian community and brought her a lot of unwanted attention. So, you know, now we'll, I think all eyes, you know, are going to be on who Scott May pick as a replacement for Carol. He said he's not going to do that until after the legislative session, which ends on May 3rd. But of course, now you know, names are already surfacing, and everything they do throughout this legislative session will kind of be viewed through that prism.
Here's Miami-Dade State Senator Dwight Bullard, who's a Democrat, who believes that Carol did no harm to Rick Scott.
Lieutenant Governor Carol wasn't bringing down the governor's image. Just the presence of an African-American woman on the ticket in 2010 couldn't do anything but help his appeal in the African-American community.
So is this a political opportunity for the governor, or is this a blemish, another blemish on an unpopular governor's record right now? Kathleen, what do you think?
You know, I don't think people really pay a whole lot of attention to who the lieutenant governor is when they're making their decision at the polls. I think it moves the numbers maybe a very tiny bit. You know, but as you mentioned, the governor's pretty unpopular already. His poll numbers were extremely low. I think it, you know, whoever he chooses probably is not going to be able to move those numbers significantly as we head into 2014. But, you know, I think everyone in Tallahassee kind of has their eye on this, want to know who the new person will be and how it will affect how he operates, you know, whether that person will be given more responsibilities and in a role in shaping policy. You know, Carol was largely left out of that. I mean, she had a very low profile in terms of what she did as lieutenant governor. You know, there is no constitutional responsibility for the lieutenant governor. So, you know, she did things like, you know, visited military bases. She worked on Space Florida issues, but she didn't necessarily have a legislative agenda. She didn't interact much with the legislature. So I think people are kind of curious to see, you know, if Scott makes a selection from the legislature, if that person will, you know, now be used in a way to shape policy and you know, affect his administration going forward.
Well, one thing that has happened this week is the focus has been on these internet cafes, more big stories today mm-hmm. about them, and, of course, prompted by arrests made in this FDLE, Florida Department of Law Enforcement, Operation Reveal the Deal is what they called it. And although Allied Veterans is registered as a charity, investigators, as Kathleen mentioned, found that from January 2008 to January 2012, only about $5.8 million of a much larger sum went to any charitable groups, including a serving veterans. Here is FDLE Commissioner Jerry Bailey.
Our investigators believe that the reality is that each gambling center is operated by the owners of for-profit agencies who funnel the bulk of the money back to themselves.
The investigation was of illicit slot machine operators who exploited loopholes in the state's sweepstakes laws to duplicate Las Vegas-style slots at these internet cafes. Manny, we've been having this conversation in Miami-Dade County for a very long time.
Maquinitas, it's very similar to the maquinitas that are set up and illegal here. And there's been a lot of push. And what you've seen locally at a local level is similar to what you've seen in Tallahassee. Influencers pumping money into political campaigns in order to keep local governments, or in this case Tallahassee, from passing any laws that could limit the amount of money that they're coming in, because it's absolutely illegal. And if you notice the Times Herald story today talked about that the sheriffs around Florida had been pleading for years to shut this down, and legislators basically were not saying. Anyway, no legislation passed, and this continued to go on.
And because maybe they were getting a lot of money from the lobbyists.
At least $2 million worth. Which now they're all scrambling to say, well, we got to look and see what we can give back. And everybody's distancing themselves from Allied.
And there's a loophole there, too, right, Kathleen? I mean, how was it that these companies are spending millions of dollars to contribute to these campaigns, which, and obviously turning out, if everything turns out to be the way it seems, running illegal fronts?
Well, I mean, some of them created different subsidiaries, so they, you know, it wasn't necessarily a to get around the idea of a nonprofit contributing to political campaigns. You know, there are a number, you know, Allied Veterans actually only represents a small number of internet cafes in Florida. That, you know, they're estimated to be about 1,000 statewide. So there are many different groups involved in contributing to these campaigns. So I think that's something that's important to remember. You'll see, I'm sure, in the coming weeks. I should go back for a second. I mean, the vote in the House to House Gaming Committee to ban internet cafes just happened about 2 hours ago. It was a 15-1 vote, and not a single person was there to speak on behalf of the internet cafes. So they are definitely seeming to quiet down and sort of keep a low profile for the moment and sort of regroup because, you know, even though Allied Veterans represents a small number of the cafes statewide, that, you know, everyone is looping them together right now, whether there's legitimate ones or not. Not all of them say they're giving their money to charity. Some say they are, you know, just a business.
Now, Janie, I wonder, with all this talk about gambling legislation, and in fact, we're moving out of the Miami Herald building in a couple of months, and that building will be torn down, and one day there'll be a casino there, who knows, maybe not, because how could something like this have an effect possibly on the gambling industry and what they might want, especially here in South Florida?
Well, I think that legislators sort of see those as two different things. You have these little internet cafes, and then you have a really large, really powerful lobby that's representing the likes of Genting and then operators from Las Vegas. And their pockets are deep. They've got time to wait this out. I don't think it will affect very much what happens with larger casinos.
So two separate things, and Manny, you think that's true, that not going to cloud one thing's not going to cloud the other?
No. I don't think initially. The difficult thing for these gambling conglomerates that want to buy here and get casino gambling passed in a statewide is going to be, you know, the lobby from Central Florida and the Disney groups, as well as the conservative Christians in the legislature, and that's going to be a huge hurdle. So more than this doesn't help, it doesn't hurt, but it's going to be more of dealing with the legislature, especially in North Florida.
We would, while we wrap this up, to tell you that we want you to give your, since we've talked about ethics a lot and they passed an ethics bill already in the state legislature, we want you to give your ethics a test. See if you can maintain your political career and stay in the clear. We have a game called Tala Nasty, and it was created by a bunch of very hardworking people here, including our producer, Elaine Chen. It's on WLRN.org. Even if you're on the level, you think that you do everything ethically correct, it'll be very hard answers there. It's called Tala Nasty. It's on WLRN.org, and we encourage you to play along. Let's move on to some other matters with the state. I'm Phil Latzman. You are listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. In our studios with us today are Janie Campbell from the Huffington Post, Miami, Manny Garcia from El Nuevo Herald, and in Tallahassee, joining us is Kathleen Hawney, who's the Sun Sentinel's Tallahassee Bureau Chief. Another big issue this week has been Medicaid, another blow to Medicaid expansion in Florida, as a Senate Select Committee on Monday rejected adding hundreds of thousands of Floridians to the Medicaid program under the Affordable Care Act. It was a party line vote. Republicans opposed, saying they did not want to expand a broken system. And this is in the state Senate. They also said they wanted to craft an alternative plan using federal money to help uninsured low-income workers get coverage through private carriers. Here's Senator Joe Negron, a Republican from Stewart, chairman of that committee.
I think there is an interest in rejecting the Washington plan, but saying, what's a Florida plan? What can we do to provide insurance, health insurance, in the private market to people who go to work every day?
So what are some of those alternative plans being discussed? And didn't we expect, Kathleen, the Senate to pass this and the House the one to be opposed to it?
Right. Well, it generally had seemed leading up to this week that the Senate was just seemed to be more on board with the idea of expanding Medicaid. But instead, what they're doing is saying, trying to come up with a plan that uses the Medicaid money and not call it Medicaid. They laid out, Senator Negron laid out five principles of what he wants his plan to look like. But we haven't seen a draft yet. What we do know is it would still cover the same group of people that the traditional Medicaid expansion would have done. So it's up to that 138% of the poverty line. It would try to use something called Florida Healthy Kids, which is kind of an insurance exchange that is set up for children of low-income families to get insurance. Mm-hmm. Basically, you apply, and there are two insurers per county. You're assigned to a particular insurer, and the rates are pretty low. I think most families pay somewhere between $15 to $20 per month. So what Senator Negron wants to do is basically expand Florida Healthy Kids and you know, have more insurance options on that, use the federal Medicaid money to have people in Florida, that about 1 million population, buy their plans through Florida Healthy Kids. But, you know, there are still a lot of unanswered questions. We're going to see probably in the coming weeks what's going to happen. One big question is the House is being, you know, although they say they want to look at some alternative, they're not really putting anything out there right now. They say they want to see what the Senate comes up with. So, you know, we're all waiting to see what happens.
Manny, where do you think this is going?
The state's looking for a way, if you can get can the private sector provide this coverage more efficiently? And as the issue here remains that there is no plan in place, there's nothing, it's still being put together, and it's really pretty much it's going to be a wait and see. But that's what I took away from it. It's a way of trying to do things more efficiently in a state that's already grappling with a lot of inefficiencies out of the Capitol.
Leaving an estimated $51 billion over 10 years on the table if they cannot come up with an idea to expand Medicaid, which is certainly a lot of money. All right, we're going to take a break with some other state issues up next, and we got some feedback also from the Public Insight Network on a bill this week that would sort of be a school safety tax, which we'll talk about with our panel. We'll also get into some more local stuff as we go along as well, and we'll continue the Florida Roundup in just a moment. Stay with us. We welcome you back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. To reintroduce our panel, it is Manny Garcia, who is executive editor of El Nuevo Herald, Janie Campbell with the Huffington Post's Miami branch, the founding editor of the Miami publication of the Huffington Post, and also with us from Tallahassee is the South Florida Sun Sentinel's Tallahassee Bureau Chief, Capitol Bureau Chief Kathleen Hawney. We'll continue talking about some state stuff and want to remind you to join the conversation with us online on our website, WLRN.org. We have a live discussion being curated by our social media editor, the hardworking Danny Rivero, and we have also all kinds of things you can do. If you follow us on Twitter, we're very active there. That's at WLRN. So school safety being discussed a lot also in the Capitol, state lawmakers in Tallahassee proposing a flurry of bills aimed at making public schools more secure. Among them is a proposal from Senator Eleanor Sobel, a Democrat from Hollywood, that would enable counties to tax for school resource officers and mental health services. It passed committee this week. Several members of the Senate Education Committee said it would create too much government, but Senator Sobel said the bill lets voters decide.
By not voting for this bill, you do not give the voters the option to decide on school safety for their kids. Do they want to make it a priority? Are they willing to reach into their pocket?
So, Kathleen, this is a Democrat introducing this legislation, which means it doesn't have a lot of chance to pass. Is there a chance that the whole Senate and the whole House possibly could go along with this?
Yeah, I would have to say that the chances are probably not good. I mean, first of all, you know, as you mentioned, the Democrats' bills don't get the top billing frequently. And then also, you know, it's very hard for many Republicans to get their arms around the idea of passing something that would let taxes go up. So I think, you know, Senator Legge, who was chairing the Education Committee, and Senate President Gates wanted to hear the bill. Originally, it was supposed to be a local bill for Broward County only. But Senate President Gates told Senator Sobel that she should expand it to give all the counties a chance to do it. But I just don't see it going very far.
Then there's another proposal that's being filed that would let teachers carry concealed weapons on school grounds, and that's coming from a completely different place.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'll see a number of gun proposals. I think they're just not a high priority this year. Given all of the major issues that the legislature is looking at, of course, you know, nothing stops a lawmaker from filing a bill, you know, whether it has a good chance of passing or not. So, but I think those will be very low priorities in the next 2 months.
Now, we asked also our friends, our informed army at the Public Insight Network for their thoughts on this, on allowing county taxes for school security. And we heard from Beth, who is in Boca Raton, who is a former educator herself. Beth, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, everybody.
So how should we do this? Is it right to ask local governments to tax to improve security at schools?
You know, our resources are so – I have two grandchildren in the public schools down here, and our resources for education are so tight as it is, and especially despite, you know, the bonuses and whatever, you know what the legislative feelings are towards raising taxes, period. And I think the resources for education would be better spent on what's important in terms of teacher quality, in terms of accountability, in terms of classroom size, and because of all of the things that we need to do to improve the educational level of our students from kindergarten on up. And I do have very strong opinions about the teachers carrying the concealed weapons around the schools, too. I think that you're inviting accidental problems with this that are the mind-boggling when you think about it. And I think there are other ways to improve the security that are short of having the teachers armed and having them responsible for this, in addition to keeping track of the children and teaching them and content and going to teacher meetings and everything else that they need to be able to do their jobs well. I think it's just an additional burden. I have family that's in federal law enforcement and proud gun owners out west, but I think the idea of having teachers walking around with a concealed weapon, to me, is a very scary thing. And to put that burden on a teacher is just beyond. So that's I do have other suggestions, mm-hmm. short of that, that you could do.
If you'd make them quick, we'd love to hear them, though.
Okay. I think that access to the schools is pretty loose. And I think that there are ways to put up cameras and to do kinds of things that are inexpensive, to have punch-coded entry into the schools and to have windowed areas where people can be seen before they enter. Mm-hmm. I think there are other ways that you can do this efficiently and for not so much money to improve the overall security of the school statewide.
Well, well said. Beth, thanks very much for your call.
Okay, you're welcome.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Nice to hear from a former educator. And, well, a lot of things bubbling up like this in Tallahassee.
This is clearly results of the Newtown shooting. One thought as I'm listening to this whole thing, why couldn't schools, I mean, a lot of organizations hire an off-duty officer and divide it among the number of parents as best as you can and have an off-duty officer work on campus during or be on campus. I mean, it makes perfect sense. I agree with you. Having, you know, an educator carrying a concealed firearm, boy, that's you could have a mess on your hands.
It's kind of interesting. At my children's middle school, my daughter's middle school, there used to be a police officer kind of guiding traffic morning and afternoon. That police officer is no longer there.
Same thing.
No longer there.
School.
Yeah. So a couple other things on state stuff before we move on. The domestic partnership bill, Kathleen, that we discussed was going to be introduced again by Eleanor Sobel. That's been withdrawn. And is there any hope of it being revived?
Well, it was postponed. The vote was postponed on it the other day. You know, it wasn't clear that it was going to pass anyway. But one of Sobel's key votes, Geraldine Thompson, was out sick that day. So without her, there was absolutely no hope of it even passing that committee. But you do have to keep in mind, Sobel is using her perch as that committee chair to have this bill heard. If she were not chair, this bill would not even be brought up. And so it's likely to not even go anywhere after, even if it does pass this first committee.
And there was one other interesting thing that happened in Tallahassee this week, which you mentioned, the foreign driver's license restriction was repealed. Now, this was something that upset a lot of visitors from Canada. Can you expand on what happened in the Florida House this week when there was some pressure from some Canadian tourists?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of times in the Florida legislature, bills get passed that have unintended consequences that you find out about later, and you know, something that will get through that is intended to help, you know, law enforcement better do their jobs. And I think that was their intent with this bill, but it ended up affecting Canadians who are down here in the, you know, a lot of snowbirds or people who are just coming to visit Florida. And so the Florida House moved to completely undo their legislation from the previous year.
About 14 million Canadians visit Florida every year, and certainly their lobby helped to overturn that. You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Janie Campbell from the Huffington Post Miami standing by. We're going to talk about some local stuff as she's been listening in, as Manny Garcia and Kathleen Hawney also on our panel. But talk about, we didn't get a chance to talk about this last week, but the influence on a national level at CPAC this week. And this actually happened, CPAC, this week, and Jeb Bush has been all over the place. So some familiar Florida voices, rather, were heard at the influential Conservative Political Action Committee conference this week in suburban D.C.
Folks, I'm speaking from experience when I tell you that there's nothing on this green earth that a liberal progressive fears more than a black American who wants a better life and a smaller government.
We don't need a new idea. There is an idea. The idea is called America, and it still works.
And those familiar voices speaking at CPAC yesterday, former Broward and Palm Beach Congressman Alan West and current Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio, both featured speakers. Here is what some of what Florida's junior senator told attendees.
If you look at our government, you have a right to be pessimistic. But here's the good news. Our government has never been America. America's never been our government. America's never been our politicians. America's always been our people.
Jeb Bush will speak today. So, Janie, just curious, if we're looking at this, what do you think Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush have to gain? And does this mean that we'll see a presidential bid for either of them?
I think it could, I think it's very likely we will. And I think in terms of Jeb Bush especially, it gives him a chance to sort of settle what was a bit of a topsy-turvy week. He put out a book recently that sort of suggested he doesn't believe in a path to citizenship for people who are here illegally, and then was sort of slammed on that, and then said, well, I wrote this book in 2012 when I was the liberal voice on that in terms of the Republican Party. So he faced a lot of criticism and then tried to sort of backtrack a little bit, and I think it gives him a chance to sort of get off that crazy train a little bit and sort of remind people why he's still a star in the party to begin with.
And the other star is, of course, Jeb Bush. He's gotten a lot of attention lately. He's speaking today. He's been in the news for a book that he co-wrote on immigration, which he says appears to say that a pathway to citizenship is not the way forward in reform. Before he went 5 for 5 this past Sunday, all 5 major news programs on Sunday, he did speak with NPR's Morning Edition last week on his new book called Immigration Wars. And the former governor says a better way is for illegal immigrants to become legal long-term residents.
Over a period of time, they can have a legalized status that allows them to live a life of dignity, but not necessarily a path to citizenship, so as to not create incentives for future people that aspire to come to our country to do so illegally when they could come legally.
All right, so Manny Garcia, does that mark a shift in Governor Bush's
position?
Yeah,
well, he's pivoting. You know, we'll see what he says today, but clearly, as you pointed out, and Janie, I mean, he got clobbered over this, over his sort of changing views. So this, he's going to be able to pivot on this. And but the other point, what I wanted to back up on was this gives Marco Rubio, this through CPAC, this is just another platform for him to just get out there, get his face on a big national scale, but also, you know, it solidifies his base. But again, he's, you know, it's a standard bearer. Now it's really Rubio, but you now have, it'll be interesting to see Jeb Bush, who's a powerhouse from the Bush family, and Marco Rubio, and how they're going to play in this sandbox.
And, you know, Jeb Bush has been asked repeatedly. When you go on a national show, you're going to be asked that question, that you're going to be running for president. He's sidestepped it, and on NPR last week, he said he would need more time to figure it out.
We just had an election, and a lot will happen between now and the time that I would even begin to consider something like that. So time would be the leading indicator.
And is refusing to take part in the new CPAC straw poll, so you think he's kind of just playing coy here?
Yeah, I think he's really considering it. But he wants to see how things play out. There's going to be a lot of moving parts to this movie, especially with Rubio. I mean, Rubio's a big player now, as we know. and will continue to grow in his sweep and scope.
And speaking of Rubio, his best friend, David Rivera, continues to be in the news. He's also not in Congress anymore, but you're, in fact, after you get off the air here, yeah, you're going to be going to a hearing involving David Rivera and the dummy Democratic candidate.
Well,
that
that's
he may have put
correct.
Up.
The straw candidate, Justin Sternad, is changing his plea from not guilty to guilty today, and he's going to admit he was part of a conspiracy to where he received money in the Democratic primary that allegedly was funded by David Rivera through a middle woman, Ana Allegra, who's fled the country before appearing before a grand jury. And Sternad has told the law enforcement, he's told the feds that he never personally met Rivera. However, he knew Rivera was behind his operation.
And the Herald and El Nuevo have done a fantastic job of reporting that story before the election and after the election.
Yeah, we broke that story. Marco Puto.
We'll continue to do it. Before we go to other stuff, but I want to mention that tomorrow in both papers, El Nuevo and the Miami Herald, special investigation that you guys are launching.
Yeah, we have a three-part series, which is very unique, that El Nuevo Herald is partnering with the Toronto Star and Canadian Television on sex tourism to Cuba. And it started with a case out of Toronto involving a 78-year-old named James McTurk, who was flying scores of times to Cuba and having sex with minors, some maybe as young as 4 years old. And he was busted when he couldn't process the film, so he went to a grocery store to have the images processed, and he got caught. So that led Toronto to contact us, and we've been working with them. We went to Cuba over the last couple of weeks, and the series will run tomorrow. It's basically going to document the sex tourism trade in Cuba, as well as how this has become a source of hard currency on the island.
And it's be also in the Herald as well.
Yes, the Miami Herald will also publish it. It'll start tomorrow. It'll run Saturday, Sunday, and Monday.
I know. We look forward to that.
Thank you.
And want to get into just a couple of local things here. Janie, you're also a music critic as well, and the Ultra Music Festival happening over the next two weekends, and unfortunately there was a tragic story about two workers critically injured last night while setting up the stage as a giant LED screen fell on top of them, and this has sort of clouded this whole festival right now, but this Ultra Festival has become so huge now, it's over two weekends in downtown Miami.
Yeah, and that's been a huge controversy. Commissioner Mark Sarnoff tried to actually kill the second weekend of Ultra a little while back, and some other commissioners stepped in and said, you know, this may not be an event we'll ever go to, but it's something that other people enjoy, and it brings almost $70 million,
wow.
I'm sorry, almost $80 million into the economy every year. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with this second weekend. Our public transportation system isn't necessarily the ideal system for dumping, 120,000 people in downtown and then getting them out without all sorts of collateral damage.
You could sleep on the Metro Mover.
Yeah, you could sleep on the Metro Mover. yeah. But it's great. I mean, obviously, electronic music is a huge thing right now. Ultra has started here. It's a very small thing. It's grown to a very, very big thing. Maybe a big success for Miami. So,
and you also, by the way, at Huffington Post this week, broke the story, I believe, on the interview that the 47% guy from Mitt Romney's infamous dinner in Boca Raton. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating guy. His name is Scott Prouty. He's a bartender here living in Hollywood. And he came out, actually revealed his identity on MSNBC and then spent the whole next day on HuffPost Live, our streaming video program. But he is just a fascinating individual, and he has some really great anecdotes about that whole experience. He'd actually met Romney before and had his favorite drink prepared in advance, and Romney just took it and spun away without a word, and it sort of rubbed him the wrong way. And so when he met him at a second fundraiser in the same home, something similar happened, and he pushed record on this phone, on his camera, and what he captured actually changed the course of the whole election, arguably one of the biggest moments. And it turns out he is a local hero who once jumped into an alligator-infested canal to save a drowning woman. So he's a fascinating guy.
It's a good read. Final word very quickly from Kathleen Hawney. We got to wrap things up. What will you be working on this weekend from Tallahassee, Kathleen?
Well, the Internet Cafe issue will continue to, I think, take up a lot of the news. We'll see the Senate will be meeting next week, so we're going to be trying to advance that as much as possible and then see what changes or that might be coming, or if they're going to do anything different than the House.
Thanks to Kathleen Hawney from the South Florida Sun Sentinel joining us from Tallahassee. Great to have you. Manny Garcia, executive editor for Il Nuevo Herald. Always good to have you as well. And Janie Campbell,
Thank you. Welcome back
from the Huffington Post. We'll do this again. Thanks to all of you. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this Friday, March the 15th, the Ides, 2013. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back to it on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. We also posted at WLRN.org. Florida Roundup produced by Alicia Zuckerman. Elaine Chen, our associate producer, our Public Insight Network analyst who got us a lot of our feedback today, Steph Farrell. Our social media editor is Danny Rivero. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. For WLRN Miami Herald News, Dan Gretsch. Our technical supervisor, thank you, Paul Leary. Don't forget, if you like what you hear, do pledge 866-247-9576 or WLRNradio.org. You can do it in our name. Until next week, I'm Phil Latzman with a reminder to stay informed, South Florida. Thanks for listening.